DBHDD is reminding Georgians to ask their doctor about alternatives to opioid pain medication. Alternatives such as over-the-counter medications and physical therapy can be used to manage pain. More information at opioidresponse.info.
Thanks for listening to the Political Rewind podcast. Be sure to like and follow us and rate us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back for another edition of Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Thank you all for joining us for today's show. I've said on Political Rewind at any number of occasions that we knew there were going to be many, many polls coming out as we got closer and closer to Election Day in Georgia, and that for the most part, we didn't want to spend a lot of time going over the results of each one as it came along, but that we always want to look at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution polls since they're right here in the state with us. And we're going to do that today because there's a brand new AJC poll that we'll talk about. And as we do that, we're also going to put into context that poll with a couple of other polls from respected polling organizations, Quinnipiac and Marist. So get ready, because we're going to talk a little bit about polls as we start the show today. And I'm looking forward to hearing what the panel has to say about the results that we're seeing. We start today, of course, with Tamar Hallerman, senior reporter at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Tamar, it's good to have you here. And at some point today, we will, as we quite often do, ask you to update us on what's going on with the special grand jury in Fulton County. But welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Bill. Always good to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. Adam Van Brimmer, who is a columnist now, used to be the editorial page editor, but Adam's turning his attention to writing opinion pieces for the Savannah Morning News. Adam, that must be a really lovely feeling to free up and be able to give your opinion in the pages of the Savannah Morning News and online.
Yes, it's certainly an interesting way to make a living, to say the least.
We're having some kind of really bad noise on the line. I'm not sure where it's coming from, but we will fix it very quickly. In the meantime, we'll introduce Chuck Williams, the reporter for WRBL-TV in Savannah, longtime journalist in Columbus, Georgia, and somebody who's followed sports and politics for literally decades down there. And Chuck, we always love hearing your perspective on the news, given your history in the state.
Well, thanks, Bill. I appreciate that. And greetings from Columbus, Georgia, where it's going to be really hot today. We had a fake fall.
Yeah. Don't worry. It's coming. It's coming. And Professor Andra Gillespie is back with us. You know Andra. She's a professor of political science at Emory University and also the director of the James Weldon Johnson Institute for the Study of Race and Difference at Emory. Andra, do you have any programs for the Institute coming up that people might be at least interested in knowing about?
Well, we run a weekly colloquium series on Mondays, so you can check our website out at jwji.emory.edu. So we have different speakers coming from universities around the country talking about all kinds of great topics. I will direct you to the website later this week. Our talk from Monday will be posted, and it's from Dr. Robin Morris of Agnes Scott College. And she gave a great talk yesterday on white women's Republican organizing here in Georgia. It was a fascinating talk, and so I hope that everybody can go check that talk out online. It'll be available within the next couple of days. And so if you go to our website and then click on Colloquium Series and scroll down a little bit, we have the talks that are on our YouTube page.
Oh, that does sound like it would be okay. I definitely want to listen to that. All right, let's get going. Tamar, so we have a new AJC poll. And let me just give the overall picture of what it shows us. The poll suggests that the one place, at least at this stage in the race, and we always take pains to say a poll is a snapshot of where things stand now, not what is going to happen on Election Day. But the one place that the poll suggests Democrats have some real hope is in the U.S. Senate race, where Herschel Walker and Raphael Warnock are essentially neck and neck. But then, Tamar, when you look down the ballot, things, according to this poll, look pretty bleak for Democrats. Kemp holds a sizable lead over Abrams. You go down to the attorney general's race, and there Chris Carr holds about a 10-point lead over Jen Jordan. And Brad Raffensperger holds basically a 20-point lead over B. Wynn. So talk to us a little bit about what you saw when you looked at this poll.
Bleak is a great word to describe how Democrats must be feeling based on many of the different races in this poll. As you mentioned, a poll is a snapshot in time. It's been a little bit since they were in the field. But still, I think Democrats were hoping for a big lift from some of these proposals that have been passed into law in Washington. Of course, the massive spending package on climate legislation, helping curb healthcare costs, as well as President Biden's student loan forgiveness program. Democrats were super proud that they were able to get these major accomplishments out the door, and they were hoping that that could really aid Democrats up and down the ballot. But as you can see in this poll, President Joe Biden is still underwater in Georgia, and that is still impacting many of the candidates up and down the ballot. We see here that just 37% of Georgia voters approve of the president. And so that makes it awfully hard for a Stacey Abrams, a B. Wynn, a Jen Jordan in order to really, kind of close these gaps here.
Chuck, beyond just what the number that Tamar just indicated, the Biden approval rating, when asked about whether the state was on the right track or the wrong track, 70% of the people who responded said that Georgia is on the wrong track, Chuck. That's troubling as well. You know what? I apologize. I'm going to take a step back. In fact, the question is the country on the right or the wrong track? And that makes a significant difference, and I apologize for in how we talk about it. So 70% said the country is on the wrong track. And Chuck, that does create more problems, perhaps, for Democrats.
I think it does. And my guess is those 70% have been in a grocery store lately. Groceries are where we're just seeing really high prices. Grocery stores are where we're seeing really high prices, and I think it's what's hurting Democrats. I don't think there's any question that the inflation numbers, but particularly grocery prices, as the gas prices have begun to decline, have been declining all summer. But grocery prices are at the core part of this, Bill, would be my guess.
Andra, one of the figures that we've looked at in the AJC polls prior to this one has to do with Abrams' support among Black voters. And once again in this poll, the crosstabs show that only 80% of African Americans who were polled on this say they support her. That means those numbers haven't moved at all since the last poll from the AJC. What do you make of that number?
I think her equilibrium is going to end up working out in the end, that she's going to get 90% of the voters, roughly, of Black voters who turn out to vote for her. There's still one, a small subset of voters who are cagey, kind of want to keep their options open, think about things, and are going to say that they don't know. And so there may be some coyness there. I think ultimately what the bigger issue is not whether or not she's going to get the overwhelming majority of the Black vote, but what turnout's going to look like amongst African-American voters and other Democratic-leaning demographics. So I think where we are now is just a sort of the reality that Democrats are approaching parity in numbers, but they have to have an exceptional turnout strategy in order to best Republicans. They're still the underdogs here, which means they're going to have to work harder to be able to win.
Andra, the conventional wisdom in Georgia is that a Black candidate, really needs about 90% of the Black vote to win an election. Do you believe that number is basically correct?
Yeah, and that's based on sort of just prior voting history from the dozens of races that we've seen Black voters participate in, since the mid-1960s. So that 90%, give or take a few, is axiomatic. And, you know, with nearly 10% of Black voters reporting that they're undecided, Abrams is within target distance of actually being able to achieve that. So I'm not surprised by these numbers at all.
And the a similar equation is that about 30% of the white vote for a Democrat, an African-American Democrat, or really for a Democrat to win statewide. And so we're going to watch very closely how that plays out in this race. Adam, let's talk a little bit about the down ballot races. I didn't mention the lieutenant governor's race, which is also part of this poll. And in that race, Burt Jones, according to the AJC polling, is leading Charlie Bailey by about 8 points plus. And this even at a time when Burt Jones has been under a microscope because of his involvement as a fake elector for Donald Trump. That certainly doesn't seem to have put people off in terms of supporting him, at least not Republicans.
There's no such thing as bad PR, right, Bill? This might be one of those cases. Lieutenant governor it's near the top of the ticket, but I wouldn't call it a high profile race. And name recognition counts for something. And Charlie Bailey is losing that name recognition fight. And as you alluded to, this election, when we get to election day, is going to be about which tribe are you in or which ideology are you in, however you want to state it. And the Republicans are going to support Burt Jones, and Democrats are going to support Charlie Bailey. And at least it appears at this point that the Republican electorate is more engaged, which is really what this election is going to come down to in the end, right? Is which party can engage its voters and its base more or better. And that's kind of, I think, what's happening down ballot and why you see so many Republicans winning or leading in the polls.
Well, I do want to say, Tamar, I hear what Adam is saying about engagement, but I think Andrew made the point too, that in fact, this is how people are responding to the phone call, which says, who do you support? Stacey Abrams, Brian Kemp, Warnock, Walker, whatever. That's not quite the same as saying, are you getting out to the polls and actually casting a ballot in these races?
Yeah, fair enough.
No.
I mean, they screen on likelihood to vote. So, I mean, we're now at the stage where these polls are of likely voters, of people who say that they're definitely or very likely to turn out to vote and not just registered voters. So, you know, we're getting sort of to a truer sort of group of people who are likely to vote. This ends up kind of, you know, falling by the wayside if people who said that they're likely to vote end up not voting. But like, they're screening to try to make sure that they are doing their due diligence to get the group of people who is much more likely to vote than those who can but probably won't.
Well, I thank you for that, because I didn't see that screen. But of course that makes perfect sense. So Tamar, Andra's saying that I'm wrong if I suggest that this doesn't reflect the likelihood of how people turning out and voting for the candidate they've told pollsters they're going to tomorrow.
I mean, it's also very possible. I know this is something that came up in 2016, where folks ended up voting for Donald Trump, even though in a poll they weren't likely to admit that. And I mean, sure, there are some people who say they're likely to vote and won't turn out to vote, but I agree with Andra. Like, most of these people are likely to vote. There's one number in here, Billy. You kind of mentioned the right track versus wrong track nationally. Mm-hmm. And in general, 70% of voters in Georgia believe we're on the wrong track nationally. But a number that kind of struck me is when you look in reference to Georgia, are we on the right track or the wrong track? And still, it's not a majority who say we're on the right track. It's about 39%, but that's still double the amount of people who think, you know, that we're going on the right track nationally. And I think that's good news for somebody like Governor Kemp, who represents the status quo and has a 4-year record to run on. It shows that maybe not as many people are willing to dump incumbents as they might be on the national level.
Chuck, I'm curious about, in terms of looking at the trending in this poll, which suggests that the Georgians who were surveyed tend to be more Republican-leaning than Democratic-leaning. There's another question in here I was interested in. If the election were today, would you want to see the Republican Party or the Democratic Party win control of the U.S. Congress. Republicans' response on that, the response from was 51% said they'd prefer Republicans to 43% who say they prefer Democrats. So add that to this mix about this sense that people in the state are more, you know, leaning more toward Republicans than Democrats. And what does that say to you about the purpling of Georgia right now?
We're definitely in a purple state. I'm convinced we're a purple state. But, you know, to what you were talking about, sort of going back to what Adam talked about with the down ballot races, and it plays into your question here, Bill, is I interviewed Chris Carr last week. I'm working on a story on the attorney general's race, and hopefully it'll go in the next couple of days. But I specifically asked the attorney general how the governor's race and the U.S. Senate race were going to impact his race. I mean, he was arm in arm with Kemp. I mean, it was like, I'm proud. You know, I've been with Governor Kemp forever. I'm proud to go. And then when he got to the Senate race, he said, it is a unique race when I want to make sure I've got his words right, with two strong candidates. And I kind of sort of stood back and said, okay, that's interesting. He said he thought that the Republican would win because of Republican momentum, the same momentum you're seeing in this poll right now. But I thought it was interesting that a down ballot guy who is impacted by, he clearly said he's impacted by the Warnock-Walker race, he's impacted by the Kemp Abrams race. But he, you know, it was all sunshine and roses when he was talking about Kemp. But then it was unique. It's a unique race. I found that to be fascinating, coming from somebody who is a Republican who with about 10-point lead, according to this poll, in a down ballot race.
Well, Adam, there's an interesting aspect of that, and this poll shows what others have. Warnock is outperforming Abrams by a considerable margin. But what Chuck's talking about in terms of what Chris Carr said about Warnock has also been said by any number of Republicans on Capitol Hill. They have been very careful in most cases to be respectful of Raphael Warnock, to say he's a wonderful person, a great preacher. We've had any number of Republican senators talk about him in very positive terms, then go on to say that they'd rather see the Republican win the race. And I find that an interesting phenomenon, and I'd love to get your take on that and yours as well, Andra.
I mean, they're trying to not look racist. I mean, you know, especially after the Kelly Loeffler, Raphael Warnock is the second coming of Jeremiah Wright fiasco of 2020, mm-hmm. right? They want to make sure that they are distancing this from them. And so it's setting this up. He's a nice person, but ignore me when I try to go for the jugular on this. And so they are looking to try to come up with a way to attack him that cannot be construed as being racialized. I think the other thing they're doing here is they're hedging. And so, you know, by calling this a unique race, what they don't want to do is be disloyal and say that they realize that Herschel Walker has some weaknesses in the race, weaknesses that could prove to be fatal. However, if it turns out that Walker does lose, right, that the Republicans can't carry him on their coattails, to victory, then they will explain that away by saying unique publicly, but saying he was a weak candidate and we knew it all along privately.
Adam?
Yeah, call me cynical here, but I just think this is, in Washington, this is what you do. I mean, Warnock has shown a propensity so far in his tenure there to act bipartisan and to court folks from across the aisle. I mean, he did some legislation with Ted Cruz, right? And so the Republicans, even though they see somebody they can work with here, they are expected to put their party first. So therefore, Raphael Warnock has a D next to his name, so therefore he's not who they want there. At the same time, right, though, by being kind of, you know, polite about it, if Warnock wins, then I'm sure they're thinking, you know, we can still work with him, so we don't want to drag him through the mud too bad.
Before we leave the whole question of polling today, I do want to point out two other very recent polls of Georgia races. just to put all this in context, as I've said, Tamara, I like using the AJC poll because it comes from the University of Georgia. They know the state well in Georgia, whereas some of the outside polling organizations may not have quite the same understanding of the dynamics here, although they are certainly good pollsters. Quinnipiac has an A rating from 538, an A-minus rating. Marist has an A rating for their polling according to 538. So let me just say this, Tamar. In the Quinnipiac poll that was released last week, Warnock is up over Walker 52-46%. And that same Quinnipiac poll showed the governor's race as too close to call. Different samples, different universes, different ways of weighting the voters. But I think it's important to point out that Quinnipiac has a somewhat different sense of both the U.S. Senate race and the governor's race, which must give a little hope to the Democrats.
You know, I love looking at Real Clear Politics website. They kind of aggregate a bunch of different polls across many, for a single race, they aggregate several different polls. So you kind of get a sense of how Marist, the AJC, Quinnipiac, Fox 5, how all of them are reading these different races. So it's kind of, you can see the spread. As you mentioned, the Quinnipiac poll had Kemp up only by 2 points, but then a Marist poll had Kemp up by 11 points. So it goes to show just how variable some of these polls can be. But taken together, you can get a better sense. You know, okay, Kemp seems to have an advantage here. It's not the biggest advantage, but it's certainly an advantage. Things could change very much between now and when voters start going to the polls. But it is worth taking all of these polls and kind of taking a step back and seeing the trends here.
Andra, you're the data cruncher on our show today. You're the one who really examines these very closely. What do you make of the differences among the polls?
Especially in the gubernatorial race, there really aren't any differences. And so one of the things that, you know, we pay attention to is what the trend looks like. And of the recent polls that have been done in the last month here in the state of Georgia, all of them point in the direction of a Kemp lead. Many of them are within the margin of error, so this is still a close race. I think that actually portends what's going to happen in the future, especially in terms of what the overall margin is going to be between Kemp and Abrams. This is going to be a close race. This race is statistically likely going to show up in most polls as being too close to call unless Governor Kemp pulls out a far and away lead. And so the average even when these averages look pretty robust, like Kemp has a 6 or 7 point lead, if the confidence interval is plus or minus, 4, then that's still a tie. And so, unfortunately, we just have to understand the limitations of polling data. Nobody can afford to do surveys with sample sizes of 5 and 10,000 where you can get that margin kind of, at or below 1%. So we're going to have to suffice with kind of understanding that the range of sort of possible answers here is going to be pretty big, and it's going to be really hard to detect that. But I take the trend seriously. And so the trend seriously sort of suggests that these pollsters aren't doing anything that's wrong or that suggests it. And I think particularly with the Warnock and Walker race, like the fact that those margins are even closer suggests that this still is going to be a close race. The results are more sanguine for Senator Warnock. But I think what Democrats need to look at this as is that they've got to get every one of their voters out to vote. Otherwise, they risk losing every possible seat that's up for consideration in this election.
All right. I got to get to a break. Thank you for the conversation about the polls. I will say once again what I've said before. We don't want to spend a lot of time day after day talking about whatever late poll has suddenly been released about Georgia races. But of course, when it becomes something we really want to talk about, need to talk about, to give you a sense of the trend, as Andra points out, of where these elections are headed, we will do that. You're listening to Political Rewind. Back in a moment.
Thanks for listening to Political Rewind. If you like this show, you'll also like Georgia Today. It's a daily podcast from GPB News, bringing you compelling stories and in-depth reporting that you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Peter Biello, for this quick and convenient way to get the best of GPB News' extensive coverage of the topics that matter to you, delivered directly to your device every weekday afternoon.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Before we get back to the panel, just a couple of comments. I think if you listen to the show regularly, you know that it means a lot to me to correct observations that are made on the show that turn out to be potentially inaccurate. And I want to do that just for a moment today. On Friday's show, there was a conversation about political consultants, the fees they make. It focused primarily on the firm that is working for Democrat Marcus Flowers up in the 14th district. They're buying Facebook ads to do fundraising for Marcus Flowers. They've raised more than $10 million, which is pretty exceptional. But in the course of that conversation, one of our panelists essentially suggested that the amount of money that this firm was, in fact, spending on Facebook ads was relatively small compared to the amount of the commissions that they were making, suggesting perhaps that they were making a lot more money than they were putting back into the campaign. We didn't talk about the name of the firm. I'm not going to do it again today. But I do think the fact that, sometimes you can get the wrong impression of consultants who are often doing very good work for their candidates. So the principals in this firm contacted me. They said that this assumption was wrong, that in fact, number one, the commissions that they're making are far smaller than the numbers that were reported about how much of a commission firms usually make, and that in fact, they've put a lot more money into the Facebook ads than was talked about on the show. If all of that sounds a little confusing to you, the bottom line is simply this. If we made a mistake in the ratio between the amount of money that the firm was making in commissions compared to the amount of money they were putting into the ads on Facebook to raise money for that, we do apologize. All right, let's get back to the panel. Tamar Hallerman is with us, Chuck Williams, Adam Van Brimmer, Andra Gillespie also. Tamar, give us a quick update on the special grand jury. One of the big questions that you wrote about is, are they going to call Donald Trump? But there's other news out of the grand jury as well.
Yeah, it's been a little slower, this news cycle out of the grand jury these past couple of weeks. But last week, we did find out one tidbit, and that is that former federal prosecutor Bobby Christine, who was brought in to replace BJ Pack as the top U.S. attorney in Atlanta after Trump essentially kind of pushed him out, that he has been subpoenaed to testify before the grand jury. That isn't exactly a surprise. We've known for a long time that the grand jury was really interested in the tumult in the U.S. attorney's office. They actually subpoenaed the AJC, which was a little eerie for me to write about. We've gotten a leaked conference call after Bobby Christine had started there, where he kind of explained to his colleagues the work he'd been doing so far and kind of reassuring him about his role. But obviously, this is just one of many instances that this grand jury is looking into to see if there was any criminal election interference in Georgia in the 2020 election.
Well, so what's the calculation about calling Donald Trump?
Sure. I mean, first of all, there's on the one hand, you kind of want, if you're a prosecutor, you probably want to fight off anything where, say, they decide not to call him, and then Trump said, "Hey, I had a perfectly reasonable explanation for what I did, and you never called to ask my side of the story, and there was a very obvious answer." That would look really bad for the investigation. So that kind of is in the column of calling him, he's a former president, give him the benefit of the doubt, give him the chance to come in and explain himself. On the other side, you have Donald Trump, who is a notorious street fighter in the courtroom who is known to kind of fight everything and to draw everything out as long as possible. He fought, of course, his subpoena that he got as part of the New York Attorney General's investigation. He was eventually compelled to come in, and he cited his Fifth Amendment rights not to self-incriminate himself 440 times. He didn't say anything other than confirm his name. So there really is a question, especially as they are on this very tight timeline, how useful is it to bring him in? What new information is he really going to give that he hasn't said already? And especially since she, you know, the district attorney has to worry about Donald Trump potentially running for president once again, is that really worth all the trouble?
Yeah. Adam, Trump, it turns out, trashed Fannie Willis during a rally in another state just the other day. And it was it was more than that he trashed her. He made references to her that were particularly demeaning. He said that she ought to be spending all of her waking hours, and then said, which are not very many, pursuing criminals, not people like me. Crime in Fulton County is up. He said the phone call that he made to Brad Raffensperger, much like the phone call he made to Volodymyr Zelensky, was a perfect call, and that the whole investigation was absurd. Not surprising for the way Donald Trump treats situations like this, Adam.
Yeah, the insults are his modus operandi, correct? That's whether it's to Joe Biden or folks in the media or anybody. I mean, this is somebody who at a political rally made fun of somebody with a physical disability. And he doesn't have any kind of boundaries, and he's going to come out and act the way he acts. And quite frankly, it's gone unchecked by a large portion of the population. So it's going to continue. And it's just something you're going to have to deal with. And Fannie Willis and these other investigations that are going on, whether it's the FBI or the Justice Department or the U.S. House Subcommittee, they need to stick to their work and stick to what is relevant and not get caught up in the circus and the distraction that comes with Donald Trump. And if there is evidence or other things that they implicate Donald Trump, then they need to follow it to its conclusion. But they also need to understand that he is going to do everything he can to try to distract, to drive the American people to the point of distraction at every opportunity he can.
Chuck?
You know, the grand jury investigation and politics are going to collide. And I saw Bluestein's report this morning where former President Trump was considering a rally in right after the Warnock-Walker debate in Savannah on the 14th. He's looking at some possible dates on the 15th. You know, think about the ramifications of that. And, I mean, Kemp is starting to build momentum. Does he want the former president, who has not been his strongest supporter, on a stage in Georgia the weekend before advance voting starts in the state? Does Walker, who is in a tight race, want the former president on a stage? And who's on that stage with him? I think it's just Greg's report this morning was fascinating to me, and we all know it's coming. We all know something. He's going to insert himself into these high-profile Georgia races.
Andre, I'd love you to weigh in on this, but I'd also love you to respond, in addition to whatever else you have to say about this, to this notion that she isn't awake many hours. I mean, that's a racially tinged remark, it seems to me.
Yeah, I mean, it is, right? So, he's basically implying that she's lazy and that she should be spending her time policing presumably Black people in Fulton County who were committing real crimes, right? Because he can't possibly be committing real crimes here. That's the part that's offensive, and it's targeted to keeping up a base of support of people who he knows he can get angry by tapping into their overt but also their latent racial resentment. And that's really sad. I mean, I think also, one of the issues is, Fannie Willis going after him in You know, in Georgia, it's Letitia James, another Black woman, the Attorney General of New York, who is going after him on the business side of his financial dealings. And so he's just evincing a certain resentment of Black women holding him accountable for, you know, following the law like everybody is supposed to do, regardless of station and what office you've held before. And so to kind of tap into that to get his supporters upset so that they will continue to do his bidding is a low point. It's not the lowest point. It's not the only one. But like, it certainly sort of reveals what Donald Trump is willing to do in order to hold on to power. And so we should all take caution at that. In terms of Trump showing up in Georgia, I mean, I expect him to. And I think the wild card here is what he says. If he's here, if it's a normal, if he makes it about himself, it's not helpful. But in particular, if he does something to undermine Republicans in the state, the way he did Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue in 2021, then it's a problem. So I think the thing that everybody is afraid of, and you don't know just because he's undisciplined, is does he get up and start talking about rigged elections and so how you can't trust the election system and don't go vote, right? Because in a race this close, I mean, and even if Republicans win, they're not going to win by 10-point margins. They're probably not even going to win by 7-point margins. We're probably looking at this being in the 2-4 point range, or even in the 1-4 point range, right? You're saying something that makes people not want to show up to vote is going to be problematic. And Donald Trump hasn't taken responsibility yet for his part in helping Loeffler and Perdue lose those Senate runoff races as well.
Well, I understand that. Yes. What would Donald Trump say on a rally stage here in Georgia makes a big, will be meaningful. But Tamar, what is the calculation for Brian Kemp? Brian Kemp has done a really, really fine job being able to stay distant from Trump without ever attacking him. He absorbed all the blows he took from Trump throughout last year, throughout the primary campaign when he was running against David Perdue, and you know, repeatedly said, "I'm running my own race," wouldn't get into the mix. So does Brian Kemp get up on a stage with Donald Trump, given that one of the reasons that he may be winning independent voters is people feel that he was able to stand strong against Trump?
Yeah, it's a tricky calculation. I don't think I could see that happening. And you're right, the governor has stayed very disciplined in this kind of tightrope walk approach where he's kind of forged his own path, but also declined to kind of get into it with the former president. And it's really paid off. I mean, looking at this latest AJC poll, more than 92% of Republicans say they're going to back Brian Kemp. I don't think that's something we thought we were going to see this spring, when David Perdue with President Trump's backing was challenging him. So I don't see that happening. I don't see Brad Raffensperger, certainly not, you know, standing on a stage with him, and probably not Chris Carr either. So who goes to a Donald Trump event? Would it just be Herschel Walker and Burt Jones, his two endorsed candidates who did make it through? And especially now that they're trying to win over kind of moderates and independents, even that could be a tricky calculation for them. And just as Professor Gillespie mentioned, you don't want to have a situation like what happened the day before the runoff in 2021, when basically it was a festival of grievances where the president just, you know, complained about what happened in November 2020. And it truly did dampen turnout in places like North Georgia, and Loeffler and Perdue lost.
Well, let me, Adam, let me point out that that Donald Trump is not waiting for invitations from people, Republicans here in Georgia, as he has it in other states. It turns out we learned last week that he's showing up on his own, Ohio and other states, where he's just decided without talking to the Republican candidates, he wants to go in there and hold rallies, Adam. That could very easily happen in Georgia as well.
Yes. Well, he's the kingmaker, or at least he believes he is. And the king is going to do what the king wants to do, regardless of any kind of logic. I think Andra pointed to Trump's activities here in Georgia before the Senate runoff, particularly up in Northwest Georgia, where he basically told people that their vote didn't count, their vote didn't matter, and Republicans didn't turn out in that part of Georgia. And in two close Senate races, the Democrats won. So that is certainly a danger again for the Republicans here in Georgia, especially as we get closer and closer to Election Day. I know that if I was, and they're not asking for my advice, obviously, but if I were Kemp or Raffensperger or even Herschel Walker, I would encourage Mr. Trump to support me in ways that do not involve him basically sucking all the air out of the room.
Well, Chuck, Trump has been the kingmaker throughout the primary season, but of course, there's now a general election underway. And I want to, if you don't mind, Chuck, I'm going to ask you this question, and I'll frame it with this. You certainly can respond as you would like. Dan Bolduc, who is now the Republican nominee for U.S. Senate in New Hampshire, having beaten a fairly moderate Republican up there, Bolduc being an extreme right-winger, an election denier, he went to Washington on January 6th, and he ran his whole primary campaign around the notion that, of course, the 2020 election was stolen. He won. Now he's in a general election. And last week, Dan Bolduc issued this statement. He said, you know, I've done a lot of studying of the election of 2020, the results. I've looked at that very closely, and I now realize it really wasn't stolen. You know, so very conveniently, Bolduc moves away from what got him the primary win.
You know, Bill, have you ever seen a general officer change his stance anyway? I mean, that's a general officer. It's a U.S. general officer who did that. But he clearly rode the horse he had to ride until that horse was no longer useful and he got on another horse. And that's one of the things you have to, and I've got to be careful how I say this, I'm trying to sort of think it and say it, but one of the things you have to sort of admire about the line that Kemp has walked here. He has been incredibly disciplined in not attacking Trump, in not saying, you know, saying I did my job. He has been as disciplined through the primary. And one of the things in that interview with Chris Carr that I did, he said, you know, Brian Kemp should have never been primaried. He should have been praised. And I think when you look at what happened up in New Hampshire with their Republican nominee, I mean, Kemp has never gotten into that situation. He's tried to be as respectful as he can in a fight that he didn't choose.
Andre, I'll close this out before I've got to get to our final break.
Yeah, I mean, Brian Kemp, I expect, is going to try to play this more like Glenn Youngkin, so be Trumpian without really sort of having Trump around. And I mean, the thing that Dan Bolduc is doing in New Hampshire is, I mean, it's a different environment, but he ran to the far right in order to win the nomination because that's where the votes were for the primary. And now he's trying to pivot back. But the question is, when the pivot is a 180 on an issue that's that important, is it a credible pivot? It's not like you're just kind of like, you know, shading things. You're actually like making a step. So I have to wait to see whether or not that's even effective in this case. The science has historically said that is a hard move to make, but he's doing it because he's running against an incumbent, and this is going to be a close race.
Well, I also think that the Bolduc statement really shows us what's the man behind the curtain. How many Republicans running as election deniers really believe that the election was stolen, but have run that way because they can win primaries on that basis? And Bolduc's statement just seems to me to make a point that most of these people may very well not believe what they've been saying about it all. All right, we got to get to our final break of the show. Back with more. Adam Van Brimmer, I want to talk about what's going on down there with Hyundai and some potential problems as a result of the new law signed by President Biden just a couple weeks ago. We'll do that and more in a moment.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Adam Van Brimmer, we know that one of the things that Ryan Kemp can celebrate in terms of economic development is that Hyundai, coming into Southeast Georgia, not far from Savannah. $5 billion investment in a plant that will put probably 8,000 plus people to work. But here's the wrinkle now. When President Biden signed the Inflation Reduction Act, it has a provision about electric vehicles. And the act says that if you buy an electric vehicle made in another country, you will not get the $7,500 tax credit that's available if you buy a vehicle produced here in the United States. And we don't know what Hyundai might do, but they have said they're a little concerned about this, and they may have to look at just whether they go out and do this full-blown creation of this plant. What's your take on that, and how's it being dealt with down there in Savannah? Adam, are you muted? We can't hear you.
Sorry about that, Bill. I was saying that sure, there's a couple of things going on around this whole project, and I'll try to tick them off one by one and be quick about it. First and foremost is the fact that last Thursday I was driving out I-16 on my way through Atlanta, and let's just say there is very aggressive site preparations going on for this factory. I mean, there was earth-moving equipment all over the place. They had cleared a humongous part of this track. They are moving fast and forward, which makes sense, as we've seen with the California law and with some of the other things that have been said around the automobile industry is EV is the future, and we've embraced it and we're going forward. So companies like Hyundai are going to move as quickly as they can to try to go ahead and get production set up and get going. So the one thing that was interesting to me, the most interesting thing to me about the Hyundai and the whole idea of this may disrupt our plans, I think an official called it a 5-alarm fire in terms of the project here, is the whole idea that maybe the size of the factory could change. I certainly do not anticipate, I don't think anybody around here anticipates, the Hyundai factory going away. There's a natural hesitation around here just because we flirted with automakers literally for 20 years, whether it was Volvo or Mercedes-Benz or Sprinter or Land Rover. We were in serious discussions, or our economic development officials were in serious discussions with all of these automakers, and they all fell through. So now that we've landed one, when something like this pops up, everybody goes, oh geez, what are we going to lose this one? I think the general feeling is we're not going to lose this one. And the fact that once they start making models here in the U.S., those models will qualify for that credit, make a difference. And as we've also seen, there is a push led, I believe, by Senator Warnock to go ahead and get that little piece of the legislation either changed or updated or something that maybe softens that or gives the credit to more automakers that maybe have a presence in the U.S.
Yeah. See, Chuck, what that makes sense to me, because it strikes me that, Hyundai is not going to cancel their plans, but this does seem to me, I mean, I'm always said I'd never be a good political consultant, but if I were a Republican candidate, I'd probably want to call out the Biden administration for creating this potential problem that could lead to, you know, a downsizing of a plant that was going to put 8,000 Georgians to work. I don't know to what extent it might enter the political debate. Maybe it could down there on the coast. What's your take on that?
I'm wondering right now if Cody Hall is listening. You still, Cody is comms guy for Governor Kemp. But, you know, I mean, anything that the Republicans can use to bring Biden into the picture in these Georgia elections, they're going to do it. And, you know, this could be one of those issues. We'll see.
It's something, you're already seeing, letters being sent from the Republican members of the congressional delegation kind of criticizing this move. And, you know, Adam is absolutely right. After years and years of flirting and talking with all sorts of automakers, this is a hard-fought victory for Georgia. And so Republicans will not be forgetting this anytime soon.
But the conundrum here is that Biden was, and Democrats were trying to triangulate, right? You want to buy American, you want to produce in the United States. So that's the populist sort of appeal. So there's a response to that. And I think because of partisanship, it's going to be hard for people to concede that these things are messy and that there are externalities to each of these decisions. But the motivation behind doing this was an idea of creating jobs in America and to try to bring production back to the U.S. so that you're not sort of caught in supply chain problems like the ones we've had for the last couple of years.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. It'll be fascinating to watch how that plays out. By the way, Chuck, since you mentioned it, good chance for me to promote tomorrow's show. Many people who were listening to us last Thursday heard our conversation with Lauren Groh Wargo, Stacey Abrams, political campaign manager. We gave Lauren a chance, with some questions, certainly. We wanted to get to the bottom of some of the things she had to say, but we wanted to give her an opportunity to talk about how she sees this campaign playing out in the final weeks before the election. And we said on that show we were going to give the same opportunity to a high-ranking official at the Kemp campaign. Cody Hall is going to be on our show tomorrow, having the same opportunity that Lauren did a week ago. Greg Bluestein and I will talk to him about where he sees the Kemp campaign today, some of the issues that they may face going forward. It'll be fascinating to ask him about the notion of what happens if Donald Trump holds a rally here in the state. So thank you, Chuck, for giving me a chance to mention that. One more quick thing. We're almost out of time, but we now know, Tamar, that DOJ has turned to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, which of course is right here in Atlanta, to ask that the court allow them to look at 100 documents that are marked as classified without regard to this special master that has been appointed by Judge Aileen Cannon down there in Florida. That's going to be a fascinating case to watch unfold. And there's a hope that the 11th Circuit will act quickly. It's a Trump-dominated court, Tamar.
Yeah, 6 of the 11 judges on this court were appointed by Trump, notoriously conservative. At the same time, because this ruling from Judge Cannon took a lot of people by surprise, even conservatives, it's possible they could rule differently.
All right. I wish we had more time to talk about this, and we will on another edition of Political Rewind. In the meantime, Adam Van Brimmer, Chuck Williams, Andra Gillespie, and Tamar Hallerman, thank you so much for being with us for the show today. We're out of time. Back again tomorrow. We'll hear from the Kemp campaign, and Greg Bluestein and I will have more about the political scene today. See y'all tomorrow. In the meantime, take care. Stay healthy, everybody. Bye.